This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hello and thank you for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElrath. And this week the podcast is coming from the biggest agricultural event in Scotland, the Royal Highland Show at Ingleston, just outside Edinburgh.
Yeah, it attracts people from not only all over the country, but all over the world. It truly is an international event. Massive numbers here this year. Incredible sights and sound, and really blessed with great weather.
The thing is that there are Scottish breeds like, for example, Highland Cows or Aberdeen Angus that have literally gone around the world. They've gone to Australia, New Zealand, Canada, North America, you name it. And people come back here to see the birthplace of these beasts, to see the very best examples that they possibly can. Another animal that's particular to Scotland is the Clydesdale horse, and I would say one of the highlights of this year's show, the 2019 event, was something called the Celebration of the Clydesdales.
Leading our parade, of course you have to start with your stock, your blood stock, and the stallion from Laura Henry goes to show the days when the agricultural societies would hire some of the top stallions to travel their areas and go round and breed again with the working mares to produce top quality stock.
You can hear Peter Small doing the commentary in the background there, but if I can stick my Tuppenceworth in, there is a lovely grey stallion right at the front, followed by a mare and a foal at foot. Behind that, there's a pair of Clydesdale horses pulling a plough. Obviously, it's up at the moment, because they take a very dim view, the authorities, of actually ploughing up the main arena of the Royal Highland Show. Behind that, I'm not sure, there's what looks like a seed driller. There might be a couple of them, yeah. I mean, Peter's just saying the same thing at the moment. And then there's a wee cart here at the back of that and a roller. And then behind that, there might be what could be a fertiliser spreader. I've never seen one like that before, but it's possible. But a magnificent array of agricultural machinery here. And the horses look magnificent. Obviously, it's all about the horses. This is what horsepower was. The Clydesdale horse was an animal that was designed specifically to work in Scotland. So the feathers on the feet, for example, the water run off the back of the heels so they don't get cracked heels. They can work in mud. Huge, huge dinner plate feet so they can get traction. They're what's known as cow hocked, so the legs come in at the back, so it's pushing from one central point. You get a lot of traction from that. But lovely animals.
And it's very much a design that's still seen today.
You can hear the traces jingling here. And swingle trees just creaking away. And the harness here, some of this is original harness, it's magnificent. This is the roller coming by. I'm going to get my toes out the road of this one.
And once the hay was cut, then the guys would go out with forks and tug it behind till it was.
The reason they have stopped this, because I mean, you know how big, you may not, but the main arena in the Royal Highland Show is huge. The reason they have stopped is because there are still animals and machinery coming in at the far end there. They are now completely all the way around the arena. Several hundred yards worth of magnificent animals and really fascinating old machinery. Do you mind if I talk to you? BBC Radio Scotland.
What is this thing?
Corn drill.
A what drill?
Corn drill.
Corn drill?
Yeah, drilling wheat, barley, rye. Put the seed in there.
So you basically just put it in the hopper
and
at the
goes
top?
Down these tubes there, into these coulters, and then it drills into the ground.
Okay.
It belongs to Benny Duncan, is this?
Right, who organised all this?
That's right.
Okay, got it.
I have to say, we've got horses at home, but they're nowhere near as patient as this.
Oh, they're on the tools today.
There's a fantastic gig just come in with what might be described as a medium-sized Clydesdale pulling it, but it is gleaming from across here. Whoever's driving the gig seems to be wearing a diamante jacket, so fair enough. Behind that, there's a couple of police horses, and behind that, there's one of the four border reavers riding them. Everybody's got their Porsche dungarees on. And that plough is actually on almost like a sort of metal sledge, so it sits proud of the ground. That's fantastic. I have no idea what that is. Quick question, what is that?
It's a potato planter.
It's brilliant!
Is that a stowaway?
I'm saying, is that a stowaway you've got in the back?
Aye, that's my grandson.
What kind of car do you call this?
A box car. A box car. That's it. Does for turnips, dung, anything at all.
Doesn't this look absolutely magnificent?
It certainly is. It's a wonderful day, a wonderful sight, isn't it? We'll never see the lights again.
Just a taste of that fantastic celebration of Clydesdales from Friday here at the Royal Highland Show.
It was brilliant, wasn't it? Absolutely brilliant.
I should have said on the way into that, count the number of times I say magnificent. I must have said it about half a dozen times. And it was. I mean, they're just superb animals.
I was setting up for Landward, the live programme, and I didn't know it was coming on. Uh-huh. And the whole crew, even the hardened camera guys, were looking in amazement at these magnificent animals. There was a couple of police girls on, police ladies on horses as well. There was so much going on. As you said, implements. I had no idea what they were.
Well, fascinating. The mastermind behind that event joins us now, Benny Duncan from Balmalcolm Clydesdales. Well, well done. Brilliant idea.
Thank you very much.
Who came up with it in the first place? Was it you?
Well, the Clydesdale Horse Society contacted me to see if I could help them. And they said they were going to do a celebration of the Clydesdales. So I just thought a celebration of the Clydesdales is from day one to the present day. Right. Celebrate the whole thing. So that's where it come from.
But people do love Clydesdales. I mean, there's a judging of the Young Handlers competition there with a very young girl with quite a young Clydesdale pony. At that point, the six, I don't know what you call them, the six...
Six in hand.
Six in hand came up with a beautiful cart, magnificent animals, just magnificent.
See, you're doing it now too.
And this pony turned round and looked at him, and if horses could talk, he was saying, that's what I want to be when I grow up. It was a delightful sight.
Just like the Budweiser Clydesdales, that's what they grew up to be. The six horses, that's six horse team. That's what they are called.
Six horse team.
Aye.
And somebody, whoever's driving that, because it doesn't seem to have, six reins going into his hands, etc. But, I mean, essentially that one person, he's got at least 5 tonnes of horse flesh in front of them.
Yes, uh-huh. There'll be 3 reins in either hand driving just each pair of horses.
Can I ask you about some of the implements? Because, yes. I mean, there was a thing going around that it looked, for all the world to me, like a modern-day fertiliser spreader. And I thought, well, it can't be, because they didn't have pellet fertiliser back then. It was a tatty planter. Where did you find that?
There's still some of them lying about in some old farm sheds yet. I just try to find them. Uh-huh. Some of these old farms are in root of hedges or something. Yeah. But they're not easy found. But there are a few round about. Yeah.
And I think the commentator made the point, and it's absolutely true. All these implements were, not the horses were brushed to perfection, but all these implements were painted up and polished, and in a way they never would have been in the old days.
No, no way. We put a lot of effort in this winter to get them to look like they did. And most of these machines were converted to the tractor when the horses finished. So had all the tractor poles to take off them and put shafts or whatever on. to get them to work with the horses again.
The ingenuity of these machines in the days before welding are just fantastic. I was standing there looking at them. How clever, how skillful.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. But all these old machines are just like the present-day machines. They're just a step, you know. The present-day machines have been taken off these old machines.
Yeah, but they're solid, they're simple, they're repairable. It's not you phone off to Germany to get another transistor for them.
No, and transistor. A lot of these machines, as I say, we pulled them out root of hedges and gardens and things like that. And the metal works just like the day they were new.
Aye.
If you get a bit modern metal, it'll never last like that.
It's good quality steel, it
good
has to be said.
Steel, aye.
It was interesting. I was looking at the drag plow was going past. And I thought, how on earth are they doing that without running the risk of actually ploughing up the main arena and at the Royal Island Show? But it's sitting on almost like ski runners.
Well, I had to make all these do for that reason, like skid things, and the wheels on other ones just to lift them off the ground so that they weren't actually working. Ken,
I can see you having one of them. You can need to clutch the horse rather than these jumpy things that you
have. Aye, much more sensible. At least it'd be useful. But you know the. You mentioned the two police riders.
Yeah.
Every other horse, every other Clydesdale horse in that arena had the full feathers.
Yes.
They don't. Why?
The reason they don't have the feathers is if they're in, a football match about Glasgow or something like that, sometimes they get firebombed.
Seriously?
Aye.
The feathers are the hairy bits at the end of their legs.
The feathers are the hairy bits at the end of their legs. And they're throwing things under the horse. Firebomb under the horse.
I was speaking to a couple of the police ladies who said they get stabbed with ballpoint pens as well. Yeah. And I was there at the training at the place south of Glasgow, and they were setting off flares and rockets and fertiliser bags, and these things were bomb-proof. Uh-huh. And I was standing at the end of it, and they trot out in a line. Uh-huh. But when they turn round and face you and come straight at you, it's a terrifying sight.
Uh-huh.
It's quite frightening.
Well, you can feel them under your feet. Uh-huh. I mean, it's a lot of horse flesh thundering down the road towards you.
Yes. If you see them trotting around the field or something, the ground does vibrate with them.
Aye. Well, actually, I'm sure you watched it too. The Strathorn ride, the musical ride, there was four Clydesdales there, all beautifully matched. They did it to music, and they were doing some really convoluted stuff, side-by-side serpentines and things like that. The crowd absolutely loved it. I mean, the stand was packed, and they just loved it.
Mm. That's very true. The Strathorn team, they do a very good effort every year to put on a show like that. They change it every year. And it was a great finale to the celebration of Clydesdale. It was very good.
How do you build on this? I mean, this has been such a huge success this year. What are you going to do next year?
I don't really
know.
It's a
secret, Mark.
I think we'll have to sleep on that one, Ken. I don't think it'll be happening next year, but we'll have another one of these days, you know.
The guy that was running around with your box cart says, we will never see this like again. I really hope that's not true.
Well, I would hope not. There was an awful lot of interest from the Clydesdale people and ourselves. Once they saw it working, they were very, very interested. So I'm sure it will happen again.
Benny, well done again. Congratulations and thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
We couldn't really come to the Royal Highland Show, which is where we're broadcasting you live this afternoon from, and not talk about Brexit. It's still an enormous issue. Basically, we were here when the result came through, 3 years ago now? Because the Royal Highland Show, as well as being a great day out, is an important business and political event for the rural and farming sector in Scotland. There was a huge sense of uncertainty 3 years ago and shock that weekend.
Yeah, the NFU released the result of our Brexit survey here at the show and asked the President, Andrew McCornick, what did it say?
It's basically saying that with a deal or without a deal, farmers are not very comfortable looking forward. It's very marginal in the with a deal part of it. Well, when I say with deal, I mean withdrawal agreement. The deal's a part we go to beyond that. They're very, very reluctant to invest in their businesses. And a big, big proportion, I think 74%, have said that as far as they're concerned, that they're not making any changes within their business, which is really unfortunate, but equally I fully understand with the uncertainty that there is in the industry, not knowing what direction to turn in, what can they do? And that's why they're probably making this decision, we'll just keep our heads down and plough on.
But that's a pretty negative way of looking at things, that's not going to get them anywhere. There is a truck coming down the road.
Well, this is part of what we are doing with this, but if you look further into the survey, there is an optimism for the industry, and I think this is what they're working. They're working their way through. They're probably burning up their cash, whatever they've got, to get them to where they think the future, the glorious future is, but very, very much reliant on governments in both parliaments delivering for them, making sure that their industry's to the forefront. And again, I believe that's a big part of the economy anyway, and employment.
What can you do? How can you get farmers to do something about it, to prepare for what may not happen, what may happen? It's such a vague concept.
Well, what we're doing with the Brexit survey is basically is looking to deliver future policy. It's a confirmation of what we've done right from the very word go on this. We're change document and then next steps to change. We're now going to be using this as an absolute solid, it's no anecdotal, here's the actual figures. This is what we'll be lobbying on, and it will then help us to deliver change. And that'll be our next document, it'll be delivering change, how do we do it? And we'll be trying to push some sorts of policies out there. So this is actually a good guide for us, but it's also getting out there and speaking to the farmers, crofters, whatever they're doing. But we've been highlighting this. It's a bit like what we were saying in the amnesty in there. We're out there, but we need to get them to help themselves at the same time.
It's time running out for farmers, though. I mean, you're suggesting they're using up savings. They can't do that for very long.
I don't think time's running out, but we're certainly needing to get a bit more guidance and clarity. The uncertainty is driving this business into a bad place. If people knew what they were doing, farmers are resilient, they would develop their businesses to make sure that it worked. And we need to get a return from the market at the same time. We need to get that clarity as well.
You're sounding quite angry about it. You're getting tense.
I'm very tense, I'm very angry, but I'm not angry. I'm just passionate, and my passion does come through because I want to drive this change. Ever if I got elected, if I became a VP, I've been determined to drive change into this industry. I feel, and the Cabinet Secretary has used a phrase that I've been using a lot, we can't ID what we've ID'd in, and we've got to get that message across.
President of NFU Scotland, Andrew McCormack there.
And he was passionate.
You can hear him.
He's getting very red in the face. It's because he feels so passionate about it. But it's really scary, yeah, that farmers are just feeling nothing they can do about
it. It's the fact that here we are 3 years on in exactly the same situation.
Yeah. Well, I put the results of that survey to Fergus Ewing, the Cabinet Secretary for the Rural Economy for the Scottish Government, and suggested that very point. It's a little scary that the vast majority of farmers have made no Brexit planning at all.
Well, in some ways, how can you blame them? Because what do they plan for? Because nobody really knows with certainty what's going to happen. Now, the Scottish Government thinks we should remain in the EU. It's been a good financial friend, a bit pernickety maybe from time to time. But, you know, we've known that the money is there. The rules are a bit prescriptive, but the money is there. We don't know that about Brexit, whether the money will be there. In fact, the Treasury have said they want to scrap direct payments by 2027. PGIs are now under threat after Michael Gove said they were safe.
PGI?
Protected goods like Scotch beef, Scotch lamb, Scotch haggis. These were safe in Europe. Now they're under threat. Will the EU honour them after Brexit? And really, the spectacle of the remaining Tory candidates for the leadership, for the Prime Minister's job, desperate to get out on the 31st of October, when the Westminster Parliament has already said that's a non-starter, is quite absurd. I mean, it's shocking that there's been such a disregard for the views of farmers, the vast majority of whom, according to the NFU survey, think that Brexit is bad for Scottish farming.
Fergus Ewing, the Cabinet Secretary for the Rural Economy at the Scottish Government. As I said on Friday the 24th of June 2016, everyone woke up with the news that the UK had voted to leave the EU. And that day, one of the first people that spoke to me was the then President of the National Farmers Union of Scotland, Alan Bowie. Well, I caught up with Alan earlier this week and suggested, as you said, actually nothing's really changed since then.
You're quite right, Ewan. Now 3 years on, what has changed? The clarity is still needed. The decisions still have to be made. Also trade, and that's crucial to us. What's going to happen there? So again, a lot of uncertainty still. Meantime, though, the country's looking fantastic. Farming's carrying on. We're looking after the environment. And again, recognition there has to be given. But we seem to be devoting a huge amount of time to a problem that should have been fixed 3 years ago.
Are you surprised? I suppose everybody's surprised it's taken that long to go one way or the other.
No, I think the enormity of the whole challenge was difficult from the word go, and I think that should have been explained at the time. And there was a lot of things being said, and I think that's coming out of the woodwork, that actually wasn't feasible. Well, we actually have to cut through that and get on in delivering what the people want and what the industry wants.
Do you think farmers farming, agriculture are ready yet. Because we were talking at the time, you and I talked, saying, this is a golden opportunity, the decision's been made, you have to embrace it. Do you think farmers actually have taken it on board?
It's very difficult because, again, unless there's clarity or certainty, what do you move to or where do you change to? There has been some progression, but not enough. I think once you give that signal, whether it's the market, and the market's trying to give the signals as well, and that's not quite clear. Interestingly, it's also what's happening in Europe. Where's the support going? What's the market's going to be? And that's quite worrying because that was always going to be a challenge there. That still hasn't been addressed.
What about the worry of a trade deal with America?
That's a big one. That's a huge one. And we've got a president, quite rightly, that's been elected, that's going for another mandate, that's actually saying America first. And I think in that situation, from our perspective with food, we've got to be very clear, well, what does that mean? And we've got to be very clear from a UK perspective is, what are you going to do in the future? Are you going to toe-brow to food coming in? We know the standards are not the same. We know there's other issues. We still don't know that. And yet we still are being asked to invest. We're still being asked to go get over hurdles on environmental, quite rightly.
Do you think that message is out there enough, how serious it could be if American beef, and there's a lot of American beef, American chicken, whatever, barley, grains come in. It could, and I've been accused of overestimating this, it could have a really devastating impact on Scottish farming.
It is, and it's there's a moment where you have to wake up and understand the consequences. And I think there needs to be a clarity from politicians to be aware of those consequences and actually show what governments are going to do to try and either mitigate them or to try and show another route as to what the industry can do. That's not there yet. And that's coming from both Scottish politicians and UK politicians. Can we compete? Yes, we can. Can we compete with low cost, just saying to hell with the environment, to hell with labour, to hell with all that? No, and I don't want to.
Are you glad you're not president anymore?
I miss it. I can be more forthright to an extent, but I still understand that the members have a problem. The members want some clarity as well. I do miss it. And I wish those that are in office the best. The issues haven't changed. And 3 years on, I don't think Andrew or the rest of the team would have thought they would have still been dealing with what we thought 3 years ago. But hey, and actually, I would be really disappointed if in 3 years' time, you and you come back and say, well, actually, Alan, it's now 6 years on. What's your thoughts?
Alan Bowie, former NFUS president there.
And there was a genuine sense of frustration because, Well, just absolute shock on the morning 3 years ago, and just a sense of desperation that nothing's moved. Anyway, to happier times.
Indeed, we have Claire Taylor here from the Scottish Farmer. What's your impression? I mean, just very briefly on Brexit. What's your impression? I mean, how are people feeling?
I think at the show there's actually not been a huge amount of talk on Brexit, which is quite refreshing at the moment. But there is still huge uncertainty because obviously the deadline is extended, and it's at a point of year where farmers need to know where the market's going to be with lambs as well. So I think for them that uncertainty is there, and we also don't know who our Prime Minister is going to be, where that leaves us in terms of a new DEFRA Secretary. Will Michael Gove still be in the job? So that is on the mind of farmers, but really this show is about celebrating the best of Scottish agriculture, and I think that's very much, it's been a real positive vibe to the show. So for me, we've moved on from Brexit conversations.
So from your point of view, is it a highlight for you? Is that a difficult one? I'm putting my tongue to work on just the sight of those six Clydesdale horses coming up with a cart with all this shining chrome and brass and smile on everybody's faces. That's what did it for me. But what about you?
Oh, well, for me, the real highlight is seeing a lot of the kids coming around the show. I mean, over 4 days, we had about 30,000 children here. And it's the 20th year, celebrating the year of RET this year, the Royal Highland Education Trust. And that is all about going into schools and educating the young generation on food and farming and really developing that important connection with our food producers. So when they go forward, they really have an understanding and support for Scottish agriculture. Seeing all those excited faces. But personally as well, I was involved with the shindig at the show on Friday night. So that was an attempt to have the largest number of eights and reels in a ring at one time. We didn't quite make the figure, but it was an incredible spectacle for all the crowds who were gathered to watch it, and it really showed the best of Scottish culture.
It had the potential for chaos, and it went remarkably well, because they started off with lots of little eights and reels all round the show ring. It was a delightful sight.
And then it finished with everyone doing a Gay Gordons, and you had people jumping the fence from roundabout, getting very excited as well. And it was great to see people really getting involved too, and that is what the show's all about.
There is this business about breaking down the divide between town and country, essentially. That, you know, 20 years ago, farmers, this is our show, and it wasn't really a showcase. It was a showcase to them, but, you know, they're beginning to understand the necessity of actually getting the story out there, the narrative.
I think farmers are, they're aware that they can be guilty at times of not really building their profile, not really putting on a showcase to the public. And if you look at some of the figures now, I mean, we've reached a record figure this year. They're still coming in the gates, but we're going to be getting a record of numbers. But over 60% of people that come here do not have a connection to food and farming. And our farmers are aware of that, and this is the main opportunity during the year for them to get the public in huge numbers in one place and really make sure they see the sort of pride in the industry, because farmers care about their food, and that's something we need to get over a lot stronger to the public.
I've been watching, our paths have been crossing for the last 4 days now, and I was watching you in action, and to a certain extent it works the same when we met Mark. People are constantly coming up to you and giving you stories, talking to you, giving you feedback from the Scottish farmer, and that must be a delight.
It's just amazing. I mean, I've only been in this job now for 2 years this August, but What I love about my job is I actually get to go out and meet the farmers all over the country. So 1 minute I could be out talking with politicians, talking with Andrew McCormick, president of the NFU. The next minute I'm down in Stranraer with a dairy farmer, and that is brilliant for me, because you need to build up that sense of trust in the press as well, because it's the press that really need to educate that message to the public.
You said that, you know, 60% of people coming through the gate nowadays don't come from a farming background. How about you?
Yes, I do. I do. I do come from a farming background. So we have a lovely herd of Belted Galloway cattle just on the southwest coast of Scotland in Ayr. So my mum is a vet, but we've got one of our sidelines is the Belties, and we're very proud of them. And people in Scotland love them. And I know our Defra minister was here. I saw he was being pictured with the Belted Galloways as well. They're a great crowd drawer.
Claire and I were chatting this morning, and we were talking to Belted Galloway people. It was a proper Belted Galloway conversation.
It was.
And I was also speaking to a Scottish butcher in Glasgow who only uses Galloways, Highlanders and Shorthorns. Mm-hmm. Is there a market for that? I said, yeah, there is. And it was great.
I think people really, they're beginning to care a lot more, and I think traceability has become a big thing, and not really wanting to draw us back into Brexit, but there's still that uncertainty of who we're going to be entering into a future trade deal with and what that could mean to our beef producers. We're a small country, so we're only going to really compete when it comes to quality. We're never going to compete in terms of numbers. So for us, we need to make sure people are really aware of that, and we're trying to really promote provenance. We want to know where your cattle are reared and where they're slaughtered as well.
What about you as a journalist? I complain about being worked hard. I'm not. Tell me the hours that you work, because you're here first thing in the morning when I come in, and you're here last thing at night. You were up till 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, I was up till 2 in the morning. The thing is, at this show, we're up early in the morning because you're at meetings all day, but as well as these meetings, it is so important to socialise and meet the people that we're representing in the industry. So, yep, I was up till 2 in the morning because you're out in the cattle line. It's a huge buzz and people are celebrating their achievements of the day as well. And it is so important that you work the full thing through, not just the 9 to 5. And as we know, nobody works 9 to 5 in this
and
industry.
And you stayed back just to speak to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm glad we got a chance to speak to you, Claire. Cheers. On Friday at the show, I'm fairly sure the production team wanted to do me some harm.
Never.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. I'll hear no word against it. Go along to the National Sheep Association stand, they said, and you get a chance for a good sit-down.
Need to be a bit faster, I think.
Thank you.
Right, we'll just... Beautiful curving arc with a shear that is a thing of beauty to watch.
I'm really running out of breath here.
Yeah. It's quite difficult because there's a whole sea of people watching this. And if you were to stop now, you'd be humiliated.
I might have to stop.
Well, I'll keep going, you can do it.
More of that ridiculous and rather unedifying spectacle later.
It was great. I was so glad you thought, because a lady came up and said, I think the BBC should do this.
Yeah, what I was particularly impressed at, you know, for a wee guy, you can fairly move backwards pretty
fast. Well, I grabbed your microphone and ran away, leaving you.
I'll do it. I'll record
it. It was great fun. It really attracted the crowds. And you did really well. I mean,
no, I didn't. I nearly killed me. I'd rub my legs for hours afterwards.
Well, we couldn't broadcast. We couldn't interview anybody for about an hour after that because all we've got is...
The Royal Highland Show used to promote itself as the greatest show on earth.
I'm going to have to think of another superlative.
Well, indeed. Something along those lines. But the fact is, for 4 days, this place has literally run like a fair. It is enormous. Tens of thousands of people have come through the doors, etc., and it is a showcase for Scottish agriculture.
It really is. I mean, you say that all the time, but I've been here since Wednesday, and just everything, you know, the best livestock, the best machinery, wonderful display of horses. I mean, just hugging yourself as it goes up there, all under a clear blue sky. When one day it was a bit wet, but all weekend it's been beautiful, and the crowds are out. It's just a happy place to be.
The only thing that let the entire show down was a small incident of poor athleticism. If you were listening before the news, you'd have heard a slightly strange clip of me sounding out of breath. Here's why.
Well, we're now up at the Sheep Association tent, and we've got an absolutely bizarre thing going on here.
Yeah, it's interesting. Jim Smith, farmer and comedian, is on top of a bicycle which has no front wheel, and it's connected to this Heath Robinson device, which has got a drive belt, which is actually powering the sheep shearing gear.
That looks like hard work. We've got the commentator here, Sybil. Tell us, how exciting is this?
This is absolutely fantastic. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this at the Highland Show before, have we?
And you've got a lineup of various people powering the bike.
We have, yes, we've got a lineup. Well, that's farmer Jim Smith there, just been powering the bike. We've had Scott Donaldson, I think we've got George Lyon coming along in a moment, so it's great to see these people coming along and flexing their muscles to power that bike.
That is more exercise than Jim Smith's done in many a year. Come on, speak to me, sing me a song.
you don't mind wheezing for a little while for us?
Got Bicycle by Queen. This is cruelty.
It is. I mean, Scott Donaldson's smiling, but he's got the jelly legs, and I think Jim's Jim's unable to speak at the moment.
Scott, how many times have you done it?
Once, and that's enough, believe me. I don't think I could manage it. Unless the defibrillator's here, I don't think I could manage it again.
I'm sure John Fyle had one in his back pocket. I saw him earlier.
Just as well he was here in case.
You should be doing this for sponsorship.
Well, I should be, definitely. I'm certainly not doing it for a living anyway.
Has this got practical applications or is it just fun?
Well, it has got a practical application. If there's a power cut and you've still got some sheep left to clip, you can do it with a bike, so it could have. It's just fun at the moment, but it has a practical application too.
I think the BBC ought to be doing the cycling bit.
You reckon?
Do you want another hand clip one to take it out more or another cyclist?
How you doing, Mr. Fowle?
You want Mark to do one? Just to...
I'll easy pedal if you want.
Mark, you want a pedal?
I'll pedal.
Okay, here we go.
I'll pedal. Right, no problem.
Mark will do it.
There you go.
Okay. Mark's getting up there. So you're going to manage on the bike?
With some difficulty.
So how long is this going to take you?
I'll just be doing the belly just now and then Emily's going to finish the sheep off.
This is my colleague Mark Stephen who's doing the cycling. How hard work is it?
As long as your shears are sharp enough, it's not hard at all. The biggest thing is getting your shears sharp enough to keep cutting. If they're shears are sharp, you should have no problem shearing the sheep at all.
Right. Emily's here. I'll just ask you, how does it compare to using an electric setup?
I mean, the blades definitely have their place on the hill, but electric shears are just far more efficient, and with today's technology, you can shear sheep in seconds.
Tell me about your shoes.
These are moccasins made from leather, and they help us grip the sheep, grip the board, and get more balance while we're shearing the sheep.
So how hard are you going to have to pedal?
Oh, he's going to have to go a few k's, and, you know, he's going to have to power on.
Well, we shall see. You ready to go, eh? Right. The sheep's prepared, ready to go.
You reckon?
Yeah, apparently it's equivalent to about 40 miles.
Is it? It's a flipping lie, honestly.
Right.
Say when.
Okay, just... They're getting limbering up now. Okay, we've got the yow on its back. It's been dragged into the centre, popped between her legs, poised, ready to go.
Ready?
And he's off.
The saddle could be higher. This is an awkward position.
How are you feeling?
Don't expect me to speak at the same time.
Pressure. Well, there's a real worry. If you don't pedal properly, they're going to injure that sheep.
That's good to know. Has she even started yet?
Yeah. Rumping on and just 60% done.
Just 60?
Yeah. Probably a bit faster. Needs to be a bit faster, I think.
Thank you.
Right, we just... Beautiful curving arc with a shear that is a thing of beauty to watch.
I'm really running out of breath here.
Yeah. It's quite difficult because there's a whole sea of people watching this. And if you were to stop now, you'd be humiliated.
I might have to stop.
Well, I'll keep going, you can do it. The final run now. Keep going. You're slowing down, I can hear it.
A bit more. Give me a couple of more sheep.
Okay.
Oh, thank God.
Give him a big round of applause.
Medic.
Well done. Well, we'll get a comment now and see how you did do. So how was it for you? You almost ran out of steam at the end.
I mean, sometimes I run out of steam at the end as well.
You going to make it?
I don't know. That saddle's way too low.
Sybil, how did he do?
I think he did very, very well. I'm not quite sure that he was quite as good as Scott Donaldson, but he hadn't put in the prep that Scott and Jim had put in. But so he did really well. I mean, the sheep shorn and everything's good. It's jolly hard work.
Sybil McPherson there, ending that piece. Thanks, I think, to everyone at the National Sheep Association Scotland. They got all our laughs anyway.
I was very disappointed they didn't give you a yellow jersey.
I have to say, somebody videoed it. They showed me the video afterwards, and it was not quite the Tour de France image that I had going in my head.
Yeah. Did you see the proper sheep shearing?
Yeah. Oh, that's scary. We're going to done with some of them speed-wise.
I was there earlier this morning, and the guy had done 16 sheep in 12 minutes. Wow. And was still powering on. It was brilliant.
Joining us now is somebody else who did that bicycle sheep shearing challenge, the Chief Executive of the Royal Highland Agricultural Society of Scotland. There's a badge to be proud of, Alan Laidlaw. Are you pleased with the show?
Oh, we've had a cracking show. You only need to look around you at the moment and see everyone having a great time. Sun's still shining upon us, and it's just been fantastic.
How did you get on the bike?
Yeah, I've recovered my breath now. It was good. I was checking behind me to see how fast the shearer was. He did a good job. Yeah.
I actually kicked off before somebody had picked up the shears, and they started roaring across the floor, progressing towards the audience. They're fairly scattered.
No, I was watching carefully. I didn't think I had too much energy to spare.
We've been commenting about how busy it seemed, especially yesterday. The car park seemed absolutely brimming full. Have you got a number?
Yeah, we're just working on the number now, and the car parks yesterday were full. The team did a great job, and we are at a record. So we're over 195,000 for the first time ever. So it's 195,400, just with the final counts going on at the moment. So absolutely delighted.
It's kind of a difficult balancing act, though, because you're getting tons of people in through the door, but you've also got to balance things like access, facilities here, the experience. Does that concern you?
No, absolutely. We want people to enjoy themselves. We're not chasing a numbers game. I'm delighted that we've had a successful show because people are enjoying themselves. You only need to walk at the gates and see people tired, but when you ask them what their highlight was, you ask them what they've had a good day, they're absolutely delighted. So no, we work really hard. The whole team works hard to make sure it works for everyone coming and having a great day out.
And you were blessed with the weather.
I can't take any credit for it,
sure,
but
I'm
really
can.
Grateful.
I'm sure
I'm really grateful it's here. It makes everything just so much more relaxed. And the one thing about the Royal Highland Show for me is you don't know what you're going to find. So to explore, it's much nicer to do that with sun on your backs and a bit of time.
There was one thing I noticed. Now, I'm maybe 100% wrong here. The stewards all seem, the professional security staff, all seem much nicer and approachable and gentle.
They love coming to the show. So these guys got event experience from all over the world, and they're professionals in what they do, but they love the show, they love the interaction. They learn lots of things. If you're standing watching a ring for a couple of hours, you get to learn what's going on. And we've got a great team, and they know how important the visitor experience is.
I was just talking to one of them, sitting on the wall around there earlier this afternoon. And she says, the farmers are getting demented with me. She says, every time they walk past with a cow, whether it was a cow or a bull, it didn't really matter. They said, what's it called?
That's right. But look, she was wanting to engage. She was wanting to speak to the farmers. And that's a great thing that the show does. It gives people soft time to have conversations. She's probably learned something about where her food comes from. She's realised that farming is an open industry. The farmers have realised that people are interested. And you can have these soft conversations, whether it be over a fence, whether it be over a gate, whether it be over a cup of tea or a can of Coke.
The other thing that struck me yesterday,
was it yesterday? It was Friday. The celebration of the horse event.
Oh, that was
where
cool.
We had big, massive, heavy horses, police on horses. It was a tremendous sight.
It was, and the Clydesdale Horse Society, who pulled all that together, have done an absolutely fantastic job. It is a celebration of the horse, it's a celebration of our history, a celebration of culture, and ultimately we're saying, look, this is what people had to do before to make your food. Tractors are brilliant, but a lot of the technology in terms of the machinery is hundreds of years old. So, no, I was really chuffed. I walked through the collecting ring there, and I felt quite humble as to all the work that had gone on.
It's interesting, we were talking to Claire about this earlier. Occasionally we take the badges off, you know, so we're not carrying recording equipment, we're not identifiable as journalists or reporters or whatever it is, and you just go and talk to folk, you know. And what I really like about it, I went down the sheep lines this morning and I was asking, you know, why do you cut and dye them that colour, that colour? And folk are having conversations with you.
And that's it, and that's what I think people don't realise, is they can have that conversation and ask the daft question. There's no such thing as a silly question. If you don't know something about your food or about the landscape of Scotland or what farmers do or anything in rural craft, why not come and ask? So I think people are in that relaxed mode, and as a great day out, as I say, people are happy to be open with you.
But it's also a big attraction. You're getting a lot of heavy hitters. I was down at the horseshoeing competition where they're making the horseshoe, fitting it, and getting marked on it against the clock. And I was saying to a girl from Canada, well, why are you here? And she said, it's the best competition in the world.
Yeah.
Here at Ingleside.
It is. And, you know, we've got people from all over the world coming to that. There's a map up on our international visitors, and there's dots from everywhere. We had a group from Canada. We've just signed a memorandum of understanding with an organisation called Agribition, one of the top shows in the world. And they want to learn from us, share ideas with us, talk to us.
Take BBC Radio there, broadcast there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm sure they'd be up for that.
Our bags are packed. We're ready to go.
But I think we had somebody from the US consulate out, and they were just asking questions. And it was a really great opportunity to have talks about beef and trade and export and opening markets up, and people are recognising that there's a huge opportunity to learn more, to do more business and to have fun.
You also, I touched on this before when I spoke to you last week, you've really upped the ante in terms of the food offering here as well.
We have, and you and you've been pretty critical at times, and we, you know, I don't like that. We want to be there.
So before you go.
Oh well, that's nice of you to say. So the board, the team, the staff team are all really passionate about Scottish food. They want to know that what you're getting here is really good, and it's Scottish, and that's why we audit it. And you know, I think that the celebration of Scots food is easy because we've got so much going on at the moment.
A suggestion for next year: call it the Royal Highland Show and Gin Festival, because if you go through the it's unbelievable how many types of Scottish gins there are nowadays.
It is, but it's just it's part of that rich tapestry. You know, I think people are enjoying it. It's a summer drink, and it's a celebration. So I just find things that I have never seen before, and you think, you know, I should know about this. I go to other events, and you always find something new, so it's really exciting.
Is it tough getting people to actually take stands, because you've got a finite amount of space here? Do you want to grow it anymore, or is this about the right?
No, I think we fill our stands. Our trade stands, our food concessions are all very well contested. People are interested there. I spoke to somebody who took a new stand this year, and they've been absolutely blown away. But what we have to get right is that mix, that alchemy, that sort of slight bit of magic to make sure that it isn't one product, that there isn't too much beef, there isn't too much gin, there isn't too many shops that people of one type. So we get a mix, and we have to get that right.
I would say it's an even broader stylistic brush than that you know, essentially an event of this size, 195,000 people, the acreage, the sheer complexity of it would be very easy just to see this as a business, but it is an agricultural show first and foremost.
If I saw it as a business, I'd be in real trouble. Our board would have me sort of dragged across the coals. They love it, they want it to be a success, they want it to promote our charitable remit, and people need to learn about want to learn about the agriculture, they want to learn about the countryside, and we're really excited to help do that and deliver our charitable remit. So we're really proud of our results. I'm really proud of the team and the directors, and it's been a good weekend.
Well, congratulations on an excellent show. Alan Laidlaw, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, as Alan was saying there, the Royal Highland Show is a great family day out, but it also attracts some of the big political movers and shakers, including First Minister Nicola Sturgeon. I asked her what the show means to her.
The Royal Highland Show is, I think, a very, very special event and occasion in Scotland. I mean, I remember In fact, one of my earliest school memories is coming here on a school trip when I don't know, was maybe 8 or 9 or something like that. So, you know, for somebody who didn't grow up in an agricultural setting, for me it was eye-opening to the life of farmers and agriculture in Scotland. So I think it's special in that way. Obviously it's a massive and really important showcase for our food and drink and agriculture and everything that goes with that. But I think fundamentally it's a way of bringing people who are not from farming and agriculture into this world to educate them about what it means. So, and it brings a huge benefit to the economy as well.
What about one of the big issues facing farming? I mean, look around here. It's mainly Maine, and they're pretty old.
Well, I've just been talking at Quality Meat Scotland this morning at their breakfast event about, amongst other things, both of those issues. There is an issue with the age demographic in farming and also the gender demographic, and those are both things that we need to change if farming's to have a sustainable future. So the work we're doing to encourage new entrants into farming is really important, and the task force that we have had looking at how we encourage more women into farming and the support around that is vital as well. So these are things that I think are very much on the radar screen of the sector, but also of government, and we're working together to try to address them.
We were outside the Royal Highland Educational Trust, and you've launched the Good Food Futures programme. What's all that about? How is that going to get children involved?
The Royal Highland Education Trust is already doing a fantastic job to get children involved and get them educated and understanding and interested in where their food comes from, and also the career opportunities there might be around agriculture and food production. So they're doing a really good job. There are other organisations involved in this as well, and the Good Food Futures is about trying to coordinate all of that better. So increase the number of farm visits that school kids can make, take advantage of the other educational opportunities, because that's vital to the future sustainability of the industry. But it's also, and I think, you know, I feel strongly about this, this is a opportune moment to be doing this. If my mailbag is anything to go by, children are more interested than they've ever been before and passionate about the environment around them. So, you know, we've got kids that are eager to learn. Let's make sure that they're getting that education.
Obviously, Brexit's dominating everything at the moment, but you've been speaking to farmers, I'm speaking to farmers, and a lot of them are really terrified at what appears to them quite a bleak prospect. Is there something the Scottish Government can do to mitigate them, to allay the fears?
Well, we're trying very hard to mitigate the impact as much as we can, but I'm not going to pretend to farmers or anybody else in any other sector of the Scottish economy that we can mitigate the impact of Brexit completely. And certainly if we leave with no deal, as unfortunately looks increasingly possible, then we can't mitigate the impact of that. We will do everything we can. I've been talking this morning about how we give farmers as much stability for as long as possible around farm payments, but a no-deal Brexit will be catastrophic. So the biggest responsibility I have as First Minister is to do everything I can to try to stop that happening. It's an increased prospect, but we've also got an increased potential, I think, to stop Brexit if we can get the forces that might back a second referendum to come together, get Jeremy Corbyn off the fence and get the momentum behind that.
What about the actual show itself? I mean, it's great you get out, you speak to farmers, you speak to folk from rural areas. But there's a lot of putting your head in the lion's mouth to a certain extent.
Well, you know, part and parcel of the job of First Minister or any senior politician is you put your head in the lion's mouth potentially every time you get out of bed in the morning. That's part of accountability, and it's a good thing and a positive thing. But, you know, I find here, of course, farmers and others here want to talk to you about the challenges they face, and the challenge that I think almost from everybody this morning that's been raised with me is Brexit. But I also get a real sense of vibrancy and passion and enthusiasm. You know, these are the custodians of our land, after our people, our most precious asset. These are the people who are producing the food and drink that Scotland is renowned for across the world. There's a lot to be really proud of here, and it's an opportunity for me to say thank you to those who work in agriculture and food production for the immense job that they do for Scotland.
First Minister Nicola Sturgeon there. Interesting idea, getting more kids actually involved, more kids into the industry. It's not always easy.
Yeah, and all-round food, it's a great thing. And on that note, there's seemingly endless free samples and cooking demonstrations. They're going on all over the place, and at one of the stands, I spotted a familiar face.
The Quality Meats.
Do you know
I'm Brian Burnett, BBC Radio Scotland presenter, and here at the Royal Highland Show, I am hosting the Quality Meat Scotland stand.
And you've done this for a fair old while. We're actually basking in the sunshine, looking out on the horses, a very loud PA system. You've got a sausage bap and I've got a bacon bap. How good does it get?
Well, the thing I love about coming here is when you're surrounded by enthusiastic and passionate people, but for me, you just eat all day. And you're eating the very best.
You know what is really annoying people? You can eat all day and still stay like a stick.
Don't know if that's going to be the case. Yesterday, I think I started with a bacon roll about 8 o'clock. By 10 o'clock, I was having pork kebabs. I had a Scotch lamb burger followed by a Scotch beef ragu. And then I had lunch. You know, it's that kind of day.
What is it about the show that attracts you, though?
First time I came here, it was an insight into a completely different way of life. I'm a city boy, I was brought up in the city, I still live in the city. So coming here, there was like an entire subculture, an entire population of people that I didn't even know existed. So every single year I come here, it's a real education into a completely different way of life and a bit of Scotland that's really vital.
You never thought of doing a themed thing on the Highland Show in your programme?
We've done themes about farming, Me and the Farmer, Can You Dig It, by the Mock Turtles, Size of a Cow by the Wonder Stuff, but there's definitely more there. We should come here and broadcast, do the entire Get It On from here next year.
I'm Claire MacDonald. I'm from Skye. Well, I'm from Lancashire, but I've lived in Skye for about 50 years. My work is as a cook and a demonstrator and a food writer. And I've been promoting Scottish produce all my working life. I'm driven by greed. I love to eat. And so everything I write and speak comes from the heart.
How long have you been coming to the show? Because the institution word springs to mind, but you've been giving cookery demonstrations for as long as I've been coming.
Our third daughter was 2 my first year, and she's going to be 41 in October. So I make it about 38, 39 years.
Well, that's quite a track record.
Well, you know, isn't it? I must be so much older than I feel.
This is a kind of loaded question, and I kind of know the answer. We always bang on about how good Scottish produce is,
yes,
how good the beef is. From an objective point of view, how good is it? How does it stack up against Yorkshire beef or Argentinian beef?
When I tell you that I'm from the north of Lancashire, my father was a hill sheep farmer. I thought I knew the best of lamb, which is my favourite of the red meats. Scottish lamb, beef and pork is in a league of its own. And it isn't just me and my taste. We see it all the time through guests at our hotel from overseas and from the south of England. Our meat in Scotland is the best in the world. And then independent evidence is the 5 native beef breeds in the world are Scottish: Aberdeen, Angus, Highland, Longhorn, Shorthorn and Galloway. And their stock and semen is sought from all around the world. So there is individual, independent proof, not just my own thoughts.
Is it a strong, and I know the answer to this again, there seems to be a real fascination for learning how to cook with it. Well, your demonstrations,
yes,
are packed out.
Oh, well, that's kind of you. I am not a chef, I'm a cook. Therefore, I think there's no awe in how people look at me in a kitchen, because what I cook, anyone can cook.
It's accessible.
It's accessible, it's doable. But we have got to eat meat. It's the easiest digested form of protein. And when we have the best in the world, it's up to us to use it and make the most of it.
Do you enjoy coming to the show? You say you've been coming to 38 years. This could be viewed as a slog.
Do you know, I love coming to the show. There's a buzz. I'm so proud to work for Quality Meat Scotland. They do and achieve so much on so many different levels. And, of course, they've got this brilliant product to sell. And we're the end of the market for the farmers.
Lady Claire MacDonald and Brian Burnett there. I walked through the food hall this morning. It is an astonishing lineup of producers that simply didn't exist four or five years ago.
You take the gin out of the equation.
Yeah, but even if you take the gin out of the equation, the folk, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff there.
And I just love Lady Claire's enthusiasm for it. I was there donkeys years ago filming, and she produced this dip. I said, what is it? I couldn't get it. But she said, oh, simple, very simple. And she took a whole chilli, 3 cloves of garlic, blitzed them up.
Yeah.
And you would never, you couldn't taste the garlic.
Really?
You should try it. It's a great idea.
Okay, and you use it with what? Just a dip?
Cheese or biscuits or whatever.
Well, there was lots and lots of cheese in the food hall.
Yeah, top cookery tips here on Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland with him, Mark Stephen, and me, Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, you go to the naughty step.
You can, however, catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on the BBC Sounds app or by heading to the BBC Radio Scotland website, or you can download the free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We always say this every week, but it's true. You know, we're fascinated by where people listen to the podcast, so email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Did you have this chat at the beginning? By the way, hi, my name's Emma, I want to have 13 kids with you.
When we were dating, we talked about wanting to have a big family. We never had a number and we never saw it being this amount.
On the next Our Lives, I'll be chatting to super parents Emma and Roy.
We bought a house and built an extension almost as big as the house.
And Duncan McNichol is a volunteer who answers an app to help visually impaired people.
It just absolutely makes my week when someone calls and I can just help them with some problem that they've got that they don't have another way of dealing with.
Our Lives with Michelle McManus. Positive stories to start your week. Monday at 1:30 on BBC Radio Scotland.
You're listening to Out of Doors on Radio Scotland. And no, it's not Saturday morning. For 1 week only, we've moved to Sunday afternoon as we're coming to you live from the Royal Highland Show at Ingleston outside Edinburgh.
You know, I can get the hang of this.
Oh, I like this.
4:30 in the morning on a Saturday morning compared to 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon in the sunshine at the Royal Highland Show, seeing some sights.
Well, there's been nearly 200,000 people through the gates here at the Royal Highland Show. In fact, I wouldn't, you know, there were a conservative estimate that said 195,400. If they don't break the 200,000, I would be very, very surprised.
Yeah, it's great. You were laughing just now. There was two stuffed dogs went past.
Soft toys, I hope.
With cowboy hats on them. Occasionally, somebody...
And they were being carried, I should point that out.
Somebody will walk past in a cow's outfit. It's just bizarre.
Well, there was somebody standing with a bee's outfit on the other day. Somebody went past with it was like a buggy, but it had, you know, it was like the you know, what do you call it again? The slurry with a finger on top or something like that.
Never. You
know, well, there was a kid in it, fast asleep. And they were just... The child was being towed about and sucking the ear of a toy rabbit.
I suppose that is part of the difficulties of the show in a positive sort of way. It is quite tiring for children by the time you get up to... Where are we now? We're coming up to 4:30 live here on BBC Radio Scotland. It's a long day out for kids, so if you are coming, bring something to tow them round in.
We have... Well, there's one going past with a tractor at the moment, a little plastic blue tractor. We just spoke to Brian Burnett and Lady Claire MacDonald about all the Scottish food and drink that's available here at the show. On Friday, I came across an alcoholic component with just a wee bit of a difference, as Alistair Trail from SAC Consulting Food and Drink told me.
This is a whiskey liqueur that we've developed with our chefs at Elmwood. It's Pete Weaker's whiskey liqueur. So it's a very smoky whiskey from Islay. And what we've done is we've turned it in liqueur by adding brown sugar, lemon, white currant, and a little bit of ginger. So it's a liqueur. You still get the sweetness of the liqueur, but you also get that smokiness and peatiness from the whiskey.
I have to try this stuff. Is this it?
Yes, please do.
Okay, right, give it a go. It's actually, it looks a bit like cough mixture.
It does, but it doesn't taste like cough mixture, so hopefully you'll enjoy it. So try and get that sweetness of the sugar and the white currants, but not overly sweet like some liqueurs can be.
No.
And then have that peaty, smoky aftertaste that you get from Islay whiskey.
See, it's interesting. People talk about a peaty aftertaste from Islay whiskies, but there's always a hint of iodine in it for me.
Okay.
You know, because all the distilleries are actually situated round about the coast.
Yeah.
And I think it somehow it picks up the taste of the sea. I don't know, I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But that is a very grown-up liqueur.
Yes. It's what they're
it's
trying
a complex
to do.
Taste.
Yeah. What he's trying to do is get away from the overly honeyed liqueurs you get and give one that actually showcases the peatiness and the smokiness of the whiskey. You think it's going to be an excellent for cocktails, for old fashions.
Yeah.
People suggesting you can add it to coffee or just with ice. So we're happy with it. It's very early in production yet, so it's not actually on the market yet, but hopefully it'll be on sale before Christmas.
See, I had no idea SRUC did things like this.
Yeah, so we do a number of new product development projects with our chefs and students at our catering college at Elmwood. So companies come to ourselves at SEC Consulting with a technical challenge, or they want to make their products healthier or use Scottish local ingredients. And we then introduce them to our chefs, who then carry out the project. We also use government funding from Scottish Funding Council called Innovation Vouchers. So the companies that are usually SMEs don't have the risk of having to pay for the work. They can use these vouchers to then get an excellent relationship and work closely with the chefs, with the students coming in and getting to get involved in the project, meet the businesses as well. But also lets the students know that if they go to do hospitality at Elmwood, they don't automatically have to work in a restaurant or a hotel as a chef when they finish. There's so many other careers they can get involved in, be that setting up their own businesses and a new innovative product, doing new product development themselves for a large manufacturer, working for a supermarket as a buyer. There's so many other career options that the students can get involved in, not necessarily just being a chef.
The nuts and bolts of this, if you've got three malt whiskies, essentially, and you turn it into this,
yeah,
does it literally add value? Does it become more valuable in the bottle this way?
Yes, we think so. I mean, I think there's the demand for the younger whiskey drinker to drink liqueurs, and this one's really targeted for that. So we think by adding it, making it different, making it quite unique to the other liqueurs in the market, there's a huge opportunity, especially in the cocktail market, which is quite popular at the moment, and trying to incorporate this as a mixer for a cocktail.
Oh, he's just asked me a question, and it threw me off completely.
Well, that, I was asking you about what that actually
Pete Ricas,
tastes like.
Pete Ricas, the liqueur.
Yeah.
It tastes delicious, absolutely delicious. It is smoky and sweet at the same time.
And it tastes of peat.
Well, it's basically three Islay malts that are in it, so it's bound to be peaty, and with a slight sort of overtaste of iodine too, which doesn't sound attractive, but if you're a whiskey drinker, works really well.
So if you have another one, is that a repeat?
All together now.
Oh, it's great. It sounds like there's so much happening innovation in terms of drink in Scotland.
Well, yes, in terms of drink, but what I didn't realise was that SEC Consulting actually did that.
You know, that's the point.
Well, that's what they were trying to basically say. It's not, you know, you come and do a degree or a course with us, etc., you're not going to end up just running a restaurant. You could be designing new food and drinks.
Yeah, how good is that?
Well, exactly. Now, you cannot come to the Highland Show and not take a wander around the cattle lines. There are some incredibly impressive animals on display, as Ewan and I discovered when we went for a look. Last week in the programme, Helen was saying that her favourite point of the Royal Highland Show is when she moves from this position, which is the main entrance area, into this, which is the cattle court.
But this is one of the great sights. Once they deem it safe, they open the doors, the public come in, they get really up close to the animals. It's brilliant.
The thing is, unless you actually work in farming, unless you work with dairy cattle or beef cattle, you can't get this close to them, really. Not safely.
Well, no, not safely. Luckily, these ones, I mean, you've got these massive Charlie bulls there, two beautiful ones, but they're all tied up. They are secure. They're just the colours, the marbling of the Shorthorn. I mean, you describe it, you're better at that than me.
Right.
Some of them are pure brown.
Well, actually, I would describe that as a dark chestnut. I mean, that's really
you
nice.
Win.
Well, right, fair enough. But, you know, and it's almost a solid colour, that one. The one next to it, however, is brindled, so that there's actually cream all the way through this chestnut colour. So you almost get a pink.
It's almost like you see confectionery, chocolate confectionery, where the black and the white chocolate are mixed together, and you give that some lovely swirling effect.
That bowl there, what's the name of it? It actually says up the top there, Balgay Journeyman. That's a beautiful animal, and it only came second.
It's huge.
What's the first one like?
Well, it's also difficult with the judging. I've talked to a few judges, because nobody's going to agree.
No.
And if you've got two that are really close, one will do it for you in one way, you know, straight back or the big, huge rear end, and the judge will go the other way. But quite often at the breed events, they'll have the judging, and then after it, there'll be a sale.
Mm-hmm.
And for any judge, it's a nightmare. The one he comes first gets a third of the price of the one that he put fifth. you know, the guys that are putting proper money up there, they know what they want. We've just moved round the corner from one of the Shorthorn lines, and we've got two guys who try to run away, sitting on a kerst, and presumably some of these Shorthorns are yours.
I look after them for other people. I'm Bob McWalter, I'm retired now, and I work for Balnibraith Farms.
So you're the guy that brings the cattle out
makes them shine, make them catch the judge's eye?
Hopefully, yes. Aye.
Can you show me one of the beasts you've been working on?
Yes, certainly.
Okay. We'll just head back into the lines.
This is one of them, and that's the...
Now, funnily enough, we were just standing talking about this, too. This is the solid chestnut and the brindle job.
That's right.
What do you have to do to get them ready?
There's a lot of shampooing for a start to keep them clean, halter training, walking them, and feeding.
Halter training's pretty difficult. Well, maybe it's not difficult for you, and I've tried it. You take a calf that's just full of energy, doesn't want to have a rope round its neck, and you've got to convince it to change its mind.
That's correct.
How do you do that?
My calming influence.
That's actually, you're half joking about that, but you're not really. Some people have got a calming influence on animals, and some just don't. Some shouldn't be let anywhere near them.
That's correct. Yeah, absolutely right. You have to spend time with them. They're like children, really. You get attached to them, and they learn.
So what's the special about the Shorthorn?
Their mothering ability, their milkiness, rearing calves, and can convert forage.
So do you choose them on the... Because I would go for the pretty ones with the markings on it, or does that not matter to you at all?
Yes, it does a bit.
What do you call it?
Roan.
Roan.
That's right, aye. That's the traditional Shorthorn colours. But you get them in roan, red and white.
Okay. How competitive does it get?
Very. You're out to beat your neighbour all the time. Absolutely, it is very competitive.
It's becoming upset.
Bob McWalter from Balnabreech Farms there. Now, Bob was telling us all about the work that goes into getting the animals ready to come to the show, but, you know, getting them ready is one thing. Some poor devils actually got to judge them.
Yeah, there's a big job being a judge at any show, but especially the Royal Highland Show. Now, my neighbour farms Highland cattle, a man called Charlie Bruce, and this
being
year,
the merciful sort,
this year he was at the show, so I stuck a microphone under him.
I've been judging stock of one kind or another now since my late teens, when I trained in the young farmers movement.
But what's it like, Charlie, getting the phone call to come and be a judge at the Highland Show? Presumably this is the big one.
As far as I'm concerned, it's a huge honour to be asked to judge at the Royal Highland Show. Everything's just set up for you to hopefully make a good job. The stock's bred by people that are dedicated to the job, and you've plenty of room. It's not like judging at some of the local shows where you're restricted for room, and if you get a big class, you can't really see the animals because they're virtually standing on top of one another.
But what's it like having the best in the country there? I know very little about it, but there were some really good-looking animals in the ring.
It's easier, actually, to judge better quality stock than it is poorer stock. If you're judging poorer stock, you tend to work in reverse. You tend to start the bottom of the class and work forward. But with the best ones, you usually always get one. It takes your eye as soon as they come into the ring. And if you've got a first, one for first, usually the rest of the section follows on from that.
Because you watch it from the side of the ring, and you agonise on it. You know, all judges, they agonise for ages, but it's the back of your head think they decided the minute that beast came into the ring.
Quite often you do. You store the ones that you want in the back of your mind, and you go and have a wee second look just to make sure you haven't missed anything. There's nothing worse than when you're finished judging and somebody comes up to you and says, why the hell did you put that beast with the bad back legs in there in the class? So, and then you have to hold your hands up and say, well, she may be bad back legs, but she's a tremendous top and arrow. Try and justify why, yeah.
So there's loads of judge excuses.
Yeah. Judge's excuses would be right, you.
What about telling one good Highland cow from another? You know, for punters here that have no idea one end of the cow from the other, how do you tell the difference?
The class A ones stand out a mile. The courage, the animal, and the way they hold their head. I mean, they know they're good, so it makes it easier for you as a judge, because the ones with the real style and character show themselves. It doesn't matter. Can a stockman can always make a poor animal look better, but can you really have to be a pretty poor stockman to make a really good one look poor?
So do you relax and enjoy it now?
Once I get started, once you get the first class out of the way, it comes fairly naturally after that. If you land with a difficult class to start away with, it makes you a wee bit apprehensive. We've trained as young farmers. If you was competing at the Highland Show here in the Young Farmers Movement, you had to give reasons in two of the classes you judged. So that makes you think about what you're doing when you're judging, because you have to be able to tell people afterwards why you made that decision. It isn't enough to say, oh, she was just an ahabone beast. And I think you've got to be able to say, well, she had a better top line or a better underline. There's things about that you've got to be able to point out to the general public if they're asking, why did such and such do?
So how good was the one that took the champion?
Well, the perfect animal's never been born yet. But the heifer that I placed first in champion today was very, very correct. You did a terrible job trying to find fault with her. And she had a bit of style, bit of class. She was expertly shown, but probably one of the best young stock handlers in the country. And she just never stood up wrong. I mean, every time she stood up, she stood four square on her legs, and she was level, and just a really nice beast.
So would you like to take her home?
Oh, I would like fine to take her home. I don't think I would manage to pay what he would probably be asking for her. That would be the problem.
Highland Cattle Judge Charlie Bruce there.
Yeah, he's great. It's a terrible place to be in the middle of the ring, making a decision that potentially everybody else disagrees with. I remember speaking to one judge and he said, you don't have that problem. He said, there's only two people happy with the decision, me and the guy that I placed first.
And that's about it.
Yeah.
That's about it. Anyway, we have a repeat offender in front of us here. Introduce yourself, madam.
I'm Marjorie Davidson, and I made my debut on Out of Doors last year at this time by offering the guys bacon rolls in the morning and having a wee chat about the kind of latest enterprise we'd had encouraging our daughter to show Aberdeen Angus cattle here after we'd been showing them for about 16 years before that.
She's back again this year. How'd you get on?
They've had a fantastic show, Mark. The heifer they brought last year was fifth in our class, and she's now a two-year-old with a calf at foot, and she was second in her class on Thursday, so we were absolutely delighted for them.
It's a hugely competitive field, though, Aberdeen Angus. We've been along the cattle lines behind me, and there's just row after row of Aberdeen Angus looking spectacular.
Yeah, I think it's been a very good show of cattle this year. Not much of a tail end at all in it. And I think the judge did have a difficult job on Thursday.
How are the youngsters, how's the herd actually developing?
The herd's developing very well. They had all four of their females were in calf last year, which was brilliant. And this year, so they've had three bull calves and a heifer calf. And three bull calves are all, the heifer calf's just a youngster, she's only about a month old. The three bull calves are showing super potential. The bull calf that's standing in the shed with his mum there, he's had lots of positive comments. So I would hope that by this time next year, these bull calves will be looking as well as and looking for sales.
Why do you want to come to the Highland Show? It's hard work. It's days on end. You came up to me and said, "You and cheer up for goodness sake. You look like you've been here for a week." We have been here for a week. Why do you want to do it?
I suppose for now, for us now, I mean, it's part of tradition. But in our previous life as managers of a herd, it was a brilliant marketing tool. And we're still finding the same for the youngsters here. Although they only have a few cattle now, it's great to see people coming up and encouraging them.
I was talking to one of the security guards around the corner there, and she said, I was shocked, absolutely shocked. There's people in there sleeping with coos.
Yes.
Says, and there's pee and there's poo all over the place. And you just think, yeah, get on with it.
Yeah, get a life, yeah.
But for quite a few folk, this is their annual holiday.
Yes, yes.
You get a caravan or a tent.
Yep.
You're not in a caravan anymore.
Yeah, we are. Yes, absolutely in a caravan. Yeah. And the young ones are back in the caravan this year, didn't get a hotel, so.
Well, seven, right.
So do you do that late night stuff?
Not too late, no.
Because we were speaking to Claire Taylor, the agricultural journalist, earlier on, and she was dancing along the cow lines at 2 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, that's quite common for a lot of them. And we tend to be really early risers, and Christina and Glenn are the youngsters. I mean, they had been coming in to check their cattle and take them out to wash them at 4:15 on Thursday morning, and there was guys still going back out to bed at that time.
It's interesting. I remember coming in here one morning, I mean, very, very early. and actually walking through the cattle lines, etc. And there were several people, and they had like two picnic chairs.
Yeah, and they're just feet up,
and they were fast. I mean, soon and ruined. Yeah. I mean, you could have played a trumpet next to them, no bother at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, nice to see you again, and congratulations with the second. That's excellent.
Thanks very much.
Well done.
Thank you.
Cheers, Marjorie. Pharma, like any industry, is always embracing technology and trying to look towards the future. At Scotland's Rural College stand here at the show, I met Dr. Alistair Hamilton, who told me how drones are being used in farming today.
Well, it's a little bit ad hoc at the moment. There's no sort of set way to use them. So at the moment, we're primarily using them for research. So we're using it as a platform to collect data that can feed into things like arable farming, livestock farming. But the way things are going, we're looking for it to become part of the farmer's toolkit, with or without our help or with other consultants coming in to help as well.
And what can you spot from a drone that you can't spot from the side of a field?
Well, for things like early onset of disease. So we can pick up disease before you can actually see it with the naked eye. So we can see a disease early, we can see things like weeds coming into a crop earlier, and so your intervention can be earlier, it can be a lot quicker and more efficient. We can also do things like do livestock counting or be able to look at livestock that are very far away. So there's actually quite a lot we can do.
Old Father Ted bit,
yes, yeah.
No, Dougal.
Yeah. Definitely.
But things, when you say you can pick up disease that you couldn't pick up with a naked eye, what kind of camera are you using?
So we're using things like multi-spectral cameras. Okay. So we're looking at the plants under wavelengths of light that we can't see, but the plant then shows up disease or virus or even just a general stress shows up earlier under these wavelengths. Okay. So we can then construct sensors that are specifically looking for certain diseases. That way we can then get in there early, intervene before we actually see anything happening on the ground.
It would seem to be a really nice idea that you could tie in a drone, know specifically where a pocket of disease was, and then be able to apply it.
That's exactly where we're going. So our bigger drones that we've got on display here, they're actually big enough to carry small sprayer units. So you can actually get to the stage where the drone can go along, the software can distinguish between what looks like the crop and what isn't a crop, and then the drone can then drop down to very low height, spray, and then go back up and continue on. Now, at the moment, that can't be done under the regulations, but the technology is there, and it's just working out the software and the ability to do it.
How far away are you from being able, basically, for this thing, you know, in much the same way as you get robotic lawnmowers, you know, that something will actually just come out of the shed by itself, overfly the field, spray, and come back again to the shed?
That's a really good question. With Edinburgh University, we've just applied for some funding to actually start to develop that, to scope it out. So you'd possibly have some sort of box sitting in the corner of your farmyard. That is then linked into the weather system. The drone then works out when it's safe to fly or not to fly. It's automatically charged. It goes up, does whatever it needs to do, comes back and lands and downloads the data automatically. This is already done in some other countries. So, for example, some mining companies in Australia have drones monitoring their mining automatically. So the technology is there. What we have to get around is making sure that the software and the hardware is safe enough, and also the regulations allow it to, which at the moment they simply don't.
There's been a constant complaint that it's quite difficult sometimes to get young people attracted to agriculture. It's toys. I mean, let's face it, you're playing with big toys.
This is a prime example. You see the number of children that are engaging with the drones on display today. And when we use these things in teaching as well, people's eyes light up. Show some young farmers a tractor, they get excited. Show them a drone, they get excited as well. So this is certainly something that catches people's imaginations.
Alistair, there's a young girl there sitting with a virtual reality headset on. What's she actually looking at?
So at the moment, she's looking at one of several scenes we've got recorded in 360-degree VR. It could be either on a peat bog, looking at peat restoration, or she might be doing some forestry felling, or she might be actually in the middle of a lambing shed at the moment. I'm not quite sure from her face which one, to be honest.
You've got another headset over there, and that's connected to what?
Yeah, so that's got a live feed from one of our drones, and that headset is controlling the camera on the drone. So when the user moves their head around, they're actually moving the camera on the drone around. Mm-hmm. So you can have the drone flying 100 metres up, 400 metres away from you, and you can be standing there getting a view of what the drone can see.
I've actually tried the 360D cram, and it's interesting because exactly the same way, you sit on basically an office chair that rotates, because it's by far the easiest way of doing a 360-degree pivot and actually seeing what's around you. Aside from sheer entertainment and PR value, what are the uses of that kind of thing? What can you use that for?
Well, one of the interesting things that we've come across in chatting to various people is actually where we can use this type of thing with people who are maybe housebound or elderly people. If we can immerse them in things or scenes that are familiar to themselves, that can be actually quite therapeutic. It's been used with refugees, for example, at the moment, in some research down in England. But we're also looking at, can we use it with older people, maybe people that have dementia and so on? Can this be used to actually help them? So this is going going beyond the farming sector, obviously, but it's a very, very interesting application that we're just starting to think about.
It's interesting what you say that, because so many things at the Royal Highland Show, you think, you know, folk have a concept about farming that it's about tatties, or it's about sheep, or it's about kai, or whatever it is. But the fact of the matter is that this is bleeding in all sorts of directions. That, you know, the footprint of this show is enormous.
Yeah, just last night I was chatting to one of the MSPs who's on our health committee, and we started off chatting about farming, and the conversation went sideways, and we were chatting exactly about this, the health implications of this type of technology. So not applying it within the farming sector, but into wider society. So yeah, you're quite right. It's certainly not just about farming here.
Dr. Alistair Hamilton from SRUC there. An interesting use of, you know, the virtual reality headsets.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Just to be able to take folk back.
Uh-huh.
And that stuff about the drones to spot target disease is just clever.
Yeah, and
any excuse to buy a drone.
Well, the fact that one of these fine days, you know, before the farmer wakes up, this thing might get up, fly out of the shed, go and treat the crop when it's actually needed, and then fly back again, recharge it.
They were also using them for sensing heat changes in cattle as well. That's what the farmer could fly over the herd of cattle, and he can spot the ones that are potentially sick from the air with a thermal imaging camera.
Uh-huh.
It's changing a lot these days.
We're joined now by somebody who's been doing this show for 15 years. Judith, explain who you are and what you are.
Hi, my name is Judith O'Leary. I'm press officer for the Highland Show, and yes, I have been doing it for 15 years, and technology has changed my job massively in that time.
See, joking aside, how much does social media play a role in the Royal Highland Show nowadays?
Our team of about 2 people during the run-up to the show managing social media all the time. We've 100,000 followers on Facebook and 10 on Instagram, and that just, it needs constant feeding, but it's a great way to engage with our audiences.
It must really, you know, it's free advertising, really.
It's free advertising, but you need to have quality content because people just don't like rubbish. So they want to see the animals, they want to see the inside, they want the back view of what's happening in the show. They just don't want marketing messages, they want really authentic content.
But you have to do that on the run-up to the show rather than here's what you've missed.
No, we do it throughout the year because people are interested throughout the year. So we look after social media for lots of different people, but the Highland Show audience is absolutely the most engaged, so they want to hear what are we doing throughout the year to get to the 4 days that we have today.
What was your personal highlight of the show?
Without doubt it was the shindig at the show, which was a Friday night extravaganza dreamt up by our chairman Jimmy Warnock, where we had farmers and members of the public dancing their hearts out in the main ring. And for me it was a real, it just showed the town and the country coming together. It really demonstrated that, and this is what this show is all about.
Because they had the 400 trying to get the one of the biggest eight some reels ever. And then they had another dance, and that's when it absolutely took off.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was not planned. So we had the people who had...
The best ones are never planned.
No, we had it pre-registered. So we had everybody had been practicing forever, and they did the eightsome reel. And then they went into another dance, and that's when people started jumping the fence and wanting to be part of it, which for me was just so exciting.
Because it almost doubled the amount of dancers. And I was looking at the side as it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it was just a wonderful interactive event.
Yeah, it was so spontaneous, and you could just see people in white jeans and high heels clearly coming from work from town and just coming to the show for the last couple of hours, and they found themselves in the main ring dancing. I mean, nowhere else could you do that for the Highland Show.
And the fact that it was in Scotland, Scottish country dancing at the show, the mass event, it was an experiment. Is that something you can develop?
Absolutely, but what was great is we had the Clydesdales in before that, so we had the unicorns, and so not only were they dancing, and some of them didn't know the dance, but they also were having to avoid lots of horse dung in the middle of the main ring, which was brilliant.
And it was exciting, because I was doing Landward Live when the unicorns were supposed to be in. They came in with 10 seconds to spare.
Yeah.
The director
before
was
they came to you.
The director was a greasy spot.
No, I was watching your stress. It was very apparent, but you managed it. It didn't come across in your how you presented it. It was great.
In the 15 years that you've been doing this, has the sort of general thrust of the show changed at all?
I think we've been really strong in that we've stuck to the core, and farming will always be what we're here to communicate, what we're here. But what has changed, I suppose, is the emphasis in which and how we engage with people from not the non-agri community. So people who don't understand what farming is all about, that gap is now being bridged, and we're working really hard to make it. And it's so important. People need to understand what our farmers are doing, and they need to understand why they should buy local and why they should buy Scottish.
It's interesting, I passed a t-shirt earlier today on the wall that basically says, farming, it's about food, stupid.
Absolutely. You know, it's about making farming relevant to everybody's life, and if you eat, it's relevant, and you need to know more about it.
On a personal level, how demanding does it get? Because you go into the press room, and there's a sea of proper
hard... Look at her, she's as fresh as a daisy.
Proper hard-headed journalists, and they're very demanding beasts.
Oh, I'm glad this is radio. I am pretty exhausted. But actually, do you know what? The agri-journalists are a real close-knit team, and we've known each other for so long. We get on so well, we keep each other going because it is a long, long day, and it's good fun. I love it.
It's a real kind of sensation of meeting old friends every year, isn't it?
Absolutely. Old friends, lots of teasing, and the biggest excitement is when the strawberry tarts come into the press room at the end of the
afternoon. It's an absolute bean fight. It's strawberry tart everywhere.
We tried hiding them, but it didn't work. Judith, an absolute pleasure as ever, and thanks for looking after us.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Journalist wrangler Judith O'Leary there. She does a cracking job every year.
She does, and I touched on it there. It's a really demanding gig, this. Mm-hmm. You have very news-hungry journalists from all over the country coming here expecting the best locations, stories, whatever, and they do a grand job.
You've got a wee red dot just on the top of your ear there. I thought it was lipstick, but I think it's strawberry tart.
No,
you see your strawberry tart.
Strawberry tarts, always, kind of bean fight. Suddenly, all the journalists are all there typing away at their tippy-tappy things, and then the strawberry tarts arrive and wallop.
Straight in there. That sadly is all we've got time for in this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast from the Royal Highland Show, Ingleston in Edinburgh. Join us for next week's podcast, because again, it's going to be completely different. We are coming to you from what you might describe as the seventh kingdom, the Isle of Man.
Yeah, the fun goes on.